This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Americans, it seems, are fascinated by their roots. Who were our ancestors? What was their ethnicity? Where did they live? In short, who am I, really? And companies are cashing in. Forbes tells us that Ancestry.com alone sold 500,000 DNA testing kits over the holiday season at $99 a pop. But what can DNA testing really help us to learn about ancestry? And when we do learn something new about ourselves, how do we internalize it? Do we come to regard ourselves and others differently? It can be a captivating journey, although not without its bumps. And as always, lines are open at 888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at @WHYY Radio Times. What do you think? Have you researched your ancestors through DNA testing, or is it better to let the past stay in the past? Joining us in the Radio Times studio, Anita Foman is a professor of communication studies at Westchester University. Welcome, Anita.
Thank you for having me.
And Bessie Lawton is associate professor of communication studies at Westchester. Nice to have you here with us as well.
Thank you.
So you both teach a course called Intercultural Communication.
Absolutely.
And I'd like to begin by taking a look at a project involving a number of students on the Westchester campus in which they took DNA tests. Tell us a little bit about what this is about.
Yes. The class started by having students come in and talk about what their backgrounds were. So each student filled out a pre-survey and talked about what they expected. And then we did the DNA swabs in class. They take about 5 weeks to get back. And then the results came back. And as fate would have it, they came back the day after the election. So the class was really popping. So when people looked at their backgrounds, they looked at it really through the lens of everything that was going on, and it was exciting. A lot of people find, most people find some of what they expect, but there are almost always some surprises in there. And the idea that we like is that people start, in terms of talking about diversity, by looking inside, looking at themselves. So diversity starts within.
So what was the overall purpose then here, Bessie?
Well, the overall purpose is really to start talking about or to find ways to talk about race in a more positive way. A lot of the time we see news articles and news stories, and they generate a lot of anger in terms of racial issues. And so Anita actually started this project about 10 years ago, and she, correct me if I'm wrong, she decided that it would be a very interesting way to start people to talk about their race or issues of race in a very positive way.
Yes, because so much of it was pointing fingers at one another, point, counterpoint. And our responsibility as educators are to be as interesting, as provocative as anybody else, and to be positive. Yeah. And so having people look at their DNA, number one, includes everybody because we all have DNA. And it interestingly pulls in people who are on the margins because they often know a lot about their past. African Americans had often talked about their past with slavery and the complexity of their DNA. And so here written on their DNA is the story that they've been telling in their families. And people who expect to be 100% Italian, for example, find that the story is a little more complicated than that. And I thought it was interesting that you started out by saying, should we leave the past in the past? Because there were a couple of people who said, I'm not going to tell my grandmother this. I'm not going to tell.
Really?
Because, they were really invested. And one of the things that Bessie has done is to move beyond our looking just at the narratives and looking at patterns. And some people jump in and dig right into those stories to try to find out what's going on. And other people sort of say, let's just leave it where it is.
Right. So as her sample got bigger, she and I were chatting, and I said, well, you know, we can really look at patterns in this data and see what are the trends that there are out there that people, in terms of people reacting to their DNA profiles and changing identification and all of that stuff. So I started joining the project about 5 or 6 years ago. And we found some interesting statistical differences among groups.
Well, let's backtrack just a moment. Let's talk about the student body at Westchester. Diverse?
Yes, one of the we'll come at it from our different points of view.
Okay,
because we are a state university, we have students from every economic background, students from all political points of view, students who are from different ethnic backgrounds. Now, I think we're still working on the racial ethnic diversity.
Yeah, but remember, we are a university in Chester County, which is predominantly white, right? And it's actually one of the richest counties in the United States. So we have predominantly white students. In terms of social class, I would say, yes, we have a lot of diversity. But in terms of racial or ethnic origins, I would say the university is really working hard. And it's been doing so with different programs to try and expand the reach of the university to all different race, racial categories.
So in this project, were there surprises? Were there students who came up to you and said, wow, I never realized that, you know, this part of the world is actually in my
community? And it leads us to have conversations about what experiences their ancestors had. We had one young man who was in class who was very funny. He said when he came to Westchester, he didn't realize there were people who didn't own guns. and so there had been some discussion in his family. And we talked about this because he said, I don't want to get framed as the guy who's not accepting or whatever. But he had some Middle Eastern in his background, just a little bit.
And he said, found this out through the project.
Yes, through the project. And he said there was really some, you know, so there were some surprises there.
And so for him personally.
For him personally, for his family, in conversations that they had in their family. So people have all kinds of reactions. Now, over the years, people have come to know, as these tests have become more common, that they might have something different in their background. But even at that, it often catches people off guard. One young woman had 6% African in her background, and she said, there's a story there, and I'm going to get to the bottom of it. No narrative. And just one other that's really interesting. There was a person who took the test who thought he was going to have all European ancestry, and it was mostly European, not all, but 65% of it was Jewish. He had never in his family had anybody say anything about Jewish ancestry. And you have to wonder what his ancestors did to survive and thrive and change their narrative.
So in the classroom, did you talk with your students about prejudices that they might have discovered that they didn't, they thought they didn't have, but that they,
Stereotypes.
What did you hear?
Well, one of the things that is interesting to me is that sometimes the discussion is framed in terms of social prejudice, right? And then they talk about how, you know, this group in society is prejudiced against that group in society. And there are people, you know, in our classrooms who probably sort of feel the same way because we are a diverse group. So when they find results in their own DNA profile, then we start talking about, okay, so we're no longer talking about groups in society. We're talking about you within yourself. There is this ethnicity or this race. How do you handle that information, right? And we always talk about how one of the best ways to reduce prejudice is to encourage people to have interpersonal contact with those who are different from them. But what if the difference is inside yourself? Yeah. How do you handle that information?
And it causes cognitive dissonance, and then it brings people into dialogue.
What were you hearing, Anita? What were students saying?
One funny situation, there were two young African-American students sitting next to a white student, and he was sharing his results, and he had some African in his background, and the two African-American students, you know, slapped him a high five. And you could see his discomfort with that because he wasn't expecting that. He wasn't quite sure what to do with it. But then, you know, you have discussion that you're still you. And so it provides, it's humbling for all of us, and it provides an opportunity because for dialogue, because I find African-American students will sometimes say our people were raped or, you know, slavery on a genetic level. The person who was raped and the person who was the rapist are equally your ancestors. And so how do you find some place of comfort with that if you've identified some group as evil or, you know, outsiders other than yourself? And so, as I said, it's very humbling.
But even between the two of us, when I received, I have done the DNA test with three different labs, and the results are slightly different, right? But one of the results came back with, I think, 5% African. And I look at Anita and I said, I've I always knew you were my sister.
And of course, mine had a little bit of Asian. And
well, now it's confirmed.
Yes. And I mentioned to you earlier that there's somebody right now who heard about the project and contacted us. And there's a way to trace back through ancestors. And he is a white guy from the South. I'm African-American, grew up in Philadelphia. Bessie's background is Chinese. She grew up in the Philippines. And what he wants to do is trace to see where our backgrounds overlap, because someplace back there, we have a common ancestor.
Apparently, in the email that he sent, he was saying that he has found that we are cousins. Yeah. That I'm somehow his cousin and you are somehow his cousin. And he's on this quest to figure out exactly how that happened.
Well, at the end of the day, isn't the figure something like we're
99.9% of our DNA is the same.
Yes. So that's the starting point right there.
So think about that. We're 99.9% the same. And some of that little bit we're not even clear on. So we have all this around that.
Curious, Anita, how does this conversation that you're having in the classroom, and Bessie, regarding the project and around our differences and our similarities, how is it different than, say, a traditional conversation you might have around race and ethnicity without talking about the DNA project?
I think traditionally people talk about race and ethnicity from a perspective of difference. Right. But
what is the emotion surrounding that conversation sometimes? As educators, what do you observe?
We see people who get angry. I mean, we have people shouting at each other in the classroom, defending their race and their behavior of their race, saying, you just don't understand because you were never in this situation. Mm. But when we start from the perspective of DNA, the conversation starts from a position of similarity, how we are all the same. In terms of our DNA.
So are you seeing less anger then in these conversations?
Yes, and it's more of an investigative process than, we capture people in an intellectual way that's as engaging as some of that emotional, reaction that people have. And also the nice thing about it is it pulls in so many different areas of education. We can come at it from a biological point of view. We can look at anthropology. I'm talking about narrative. Right. And one of the conversations that we have is about what does it mean to be authentic? What does it mean to be authentically Chinese? What does it mean to be authentically African American? One really interesting story, there's a young woman who is Chinese. She's adopted, and her DNA came back 98% Chinese. Mm-hmm. And she said she was adopted by a family who is German. They speak German. That was her family culture. And she said that she went to her boyfriend's house and they said, "Where are you from? Or, what's your bad?" And she said, "I'm German." And she said they burst into laughter.
Yeah.
But for her, that's her identity.
That's her culture, sure.
So what's the relationship between what's in that genetic profile and the narrative that she grew up with? And it gets more complicated when you look at African Americans. We tested people who identify as African American who have no African ancestry. And we've had people drop out of the project because I think they think if somebody knows that about me, that's going to be a problem. So the whole issue.
Actually,
you know what? I'm going to jump in and we'll hold that thought because we're coming up against a break. Genetic ancestry testing has given many of us real insight into our biological makeup. How do we define ourselves? We've got Bessie Lawton, a professor at Westchester University, also Anita Foman, professor at Westchester University. And after the break, we are joined by Alondra Nelson, Dean of Social Science at Columbia University. And again, if you'd like to join the conversation, here's the number, 888-477-9499. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. In this hour, our focus is DNA testing for ancestry and how this can help to reshape identity. We are chatting in studio this hour with Anita Foman, professor of communication studies at Westchester University. Bessie Lawton is an associate professor of communication studies at Westchester University. And we'd also like to welcome to the conversation now Alondra Nelson, dean of social science at Columbia University and the author of The Social Life of DNA, Race, Reparations, and Reconciliation After the Genome. Welcome to Radio Times, Alondra.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
So in reading through some notes from an interview you did for NPR last year, Alondra, you say, many people talk to me about living their whole lives wanting to know who they were in the sense of who they were before the slave trade, who they were with regards to African ancestry. Can you tell us about this?
Sure. You know, I came to this project very much as someone who was and remains in some ways skeptical of genetic ancestry testing and sort of skeptical of why people would want to use it. And very soon in my research, it became clear that it was deeply meaningful for people and that, you know, we use in the United States African-American as a hyphenated identity, and we use it in the same way we'd use Italian-American or Scottish-American. But Africa is a continent, you know, and as opposed to these other identities, which are, you know, nation state based. And so there's a lot that African-Americans don't know and that people variously talk to me about feeling incomplete without having this knowledge, even as they understood that the kind of information that genetic ancestry testing can provide is often incomplete in itself.
So what is being able to identify, say, as Kenyan American bring to the table?
It brings a level of specificity to one's experience and one's story that wasn't available to many African Americans before. And it also opens up these extraordinary new journeys. So new forms of affiliation with people and often in local communities who are from an ethnic group or a nation state that someone's been inferred to be linked to. It opens up new interests. This even happened for me, as a skeptic of this endeavor in some regard. You know, I had a mitochondrial matrilineal test that inferred me to be linked to the Bamileke people of Cameroon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I became deeply interested in the news stories about Cameroon in a way that I hadn't been before. But the tests also do the work of making history feel more present. So, you know, a lot of people who dismiss the sort of very alive and living after effects of slavery in the contemporary United States say, you know, that happened so long ago, how could it possibly matter? Yeah. And, you know, an ancestry inference that gives you a best guess at what, you know, a pre-Middle Passage identity might have been, again, not accounting for the fact that Kenya didn't exist during the slave trade as that country, mm-hmm. That it was unlikely that people would have traveled from Kenya to ports of disembankment on the Middle Passage journey. You know, there's all sorts of qualifications. But, you know, it makes something that seems so distant to us and is a very kind of abstract history, very personal because it's about individuals, and it becomes much more alive because it's about people that we know. It's about your neighbors. It's about people that you love. It's about people that you go to school with. Mm-hmm. So this history of slavery takes on potentially a very new and kind of urgent experience through the use of genetic ancestry testing.
All right. Anita's going to jump in here for a moment, and then we're going to get to the phones. We've got lots of calls coming into Radio Times. Anita?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up because when I tested myself, I have background in Ghana, and I had been to Ghana and went to the place where they show the wall, the door of no return. And when I saw my results, I thought, oh my God, some of my relatives, probably my ancestors, went through that door literally. And also I have colleagues who are from Ghana, and we connected in a really special way. So I was already hooked. And when I tested myself 10 years in, it really was complete for me.
All right. Let's get to the phones. Mike in Sewell, New Jersey. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I know that your conversation is mostly talking about the psychological aspects of discovering your ancestry. I've taken an ancestry DNA test. I'm 10% Irish, 9% Swedish, 4% Italian, 24% West European, and 55% British. Mm-hmm. I wasn't aware of a couple of those, but my question pertains to this. My mother did her test as well and discovered that she is heavily East European, and I know not adopted. So my question is, how accurate are these tests, and how can I further research my actual ancestry more accurately?
Good questions, Mike. Let's say, you know, one of the issues with some of this testing is that they can only test so much. Anita, you're nodding your head.
Well, I'm not an expert in this area, and the mitochondrial testing is the most precise. It's the most narrow, and there are error ranges and all of that. And also, it depends upon their database. They can only test to the extent that they have somebody to whom they can compare your profile. It's getting better and better all the time, but as was stated before, this is just one piece of the puzzle. So.
But one thing to remember too is that we don't really inherit 50% of our genes from one parent and 50% from the other parent, right? Our genetic history is made up of thousands of years, and for each of the generations, there was DNA that was chosen and was passed on, and it's not always 50%, 50%. Yeah. So your DNA profile may not match, or half of your DNA profile will not match what your mom's is and what your dad's is.
Interestingly, too, 60 Minutes pointed out a while back that if you go back 20 generations, mm-hmm. one person has over a million great, 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 et cetera, great, great, great grandparents. So we can only really glean a tiny fraction from testing. So Alondra Nelson, back to you. How much to heart then do we take this with this knowledge?
I think we should, you know, Mike's question is, I think, really gets to the heart of the matter because, you know, there are two things that we have to consider here. You know, as a social scientist, I'm deeply interested in what Mike called the psychological aspects, what people do with these tests, how they mobilize them in the world to make identity claims, to form new kinds of communities and new kinds of affiliation. But they're very, very constrained as science. I mean, what we take as the gold standard of science, that you can, that the databases are transparent, that you have access to the algorithmic assumptions and the statistical assumptions that the companies are making, that you can find out what's in the database. You know, basic information about the assumptions that the companies are making are not available to us. So one of the questions of accuracy are about the inability to have the kind of verifiability and reproducibility that we really value in gold standard science. So there's that piece. And certainly, as Professor Foman said, you know, people do not receive from their parents, 50% of the DNA. So profiles between parents and children can be very different. Profiles between siblings can be very different. And these are made, all of these profiles are created on, you know, laboratory scientists making statistical assumptions about what a category like Western European, and thinking of Mike's findings, Irish, uh-huh. mean.
What do they mean? Do we know?
We don't know. You don't know as a consumer. You know, you have to trust that companies are using the best papers, you know, the best peer-reviewed science papers to draw on the markers that they think most powerfully suggest identities in certain regions in the world. But certainly as an individual consumer, you can't know for sure.
And we drop people into buckets as if ancestry is this or that. But of uh-huh. course, the human trek is flowing and it goes back on itself. So as she commented that labs are making the best decisions. And at the beginning, I called this project Science and Magic, thinking that the science was objective. But humans are making decisions about these proprietary tests, et cetera. So there's always a human element of decision making.
Hey, Bessie.
And also, it's only one piece of information that we all use in the process of identification. And we are finding that for a lot of people, DNA, which we presume to be definitive in hard science, really doesn't play as big a role as things such as cultural experiences or family narratives in how they identify. So it's only one piece of the puzzle.
In a New York Times article a while back, Dr. Douglas C. Wallace, who's a professor of molecular genetics, says, and I'm paraphrasing here, unfortunately for social harmony, the human brain is exquisitely attuned to differences in packaging details, prompting people to exaggerate the significance of what has come to be called race. Packaging details. I hadn't heard it put quite that way before. A simple phrase, but Alondra Nelson, so difficult for humans to navigate.
Sure. You know, I think that I was listening to a little bit of your conversation before I joined, and this part, you know, the conversation you were having with Professor Foman and Lawton about difference and similarity. I mean, one of the great, advances of the Human Genome Project is that it really, underscored for us that human similarity is the sort of profound message out of genetic research. Mm-hmm. But it's also the case that we have more computing power and more sort of sophisticated science that can really, really sort of pursue that vein of difference that's 0.1% between human groups, right?
0.1%.
And so then the packaging of the details, if you think, use that wonderful phrase and think about genetic ancestry testing, is the way that various, direct-to-consumer companies use algorithms to make sense of and give people stories about what those that 0.1% difference is. Noting that some companies give you haplotype groups, some companies give you ethnic, you know, nation states. Companies also give you different information. So there's even different ways to package molecular details.
Okay. Back to the phones. Tony in Abington, you are live on Radio Times. Hi, Tony.
Hi. Hi. My question is, one of the guests earlier said there was someone who thought he was completely European, and then he found out he was 65% Jewish. And I don't understand the difference. How can you tell someone's religion because there were many Jewish people in Europe?
Yeah, so, that was one of our callers. Right. And, you know, thank you, Tony. That's a great question.
Yes, and the way that you identify any group is that they stay within the group, they marry within, so that they have certain mutations that are in common. And there's a whole discussion about which labs are interested in what characteristics. And so they are really identifying a particular group of people who have identified as Jewish, not all people. And they're not, obviously, not relating it in terms of religion, but of a genetic characteristic. There are people who study the Amish, for example, because they stay within their group and they have certain diseases and conditions that are common to them. And all of this is based on people segregating themselves. And so you can identify a group of people who are Jewish who have married within that group and therefore have common markers. That's all it is. And you can, you know, you can do it based on many things, as was said before.
Let's get back to the student project at Westchester University. Have you heard stories from students who during the election season and post-election, you know, faced pushback because of who they are? And I'm going somewhere with this because, again, you've got the conversation. We're in such a volatile time right now, and many would say a divisive time. Bessie or Anita?
Well, I had one student. This was from a project several years ago, and she's since graduated and gotten a professional job in the area. When we tested her, she came up as heavily Latina, and she said, "I do not identify in that way." And so we asked the lab, this is back to the decisions that labs make, to test her, taking out that possibility, because that is a combination of other things that they're calling Latina. And it came back African and, you know, Iberian Peninsula and different things. But she was at the pump of the gas station the day after the election. And a lot of people were very pumped up after that happened. And she and another white gentleman reached for the pump at the same time. And she said he mumbled something about her taking the pump. And he said, "Go back to Mexico." Mm-hmm. And she said she thought, "I'm not Latina." But it's interesting that her profile came out in that way. And I think the idea that it relates to here is that we start looking at each other and putting each other into these categories and then treating each other as things and as objects. And our whole idea here is to create humanity that we share.
There were two other respondents or participants. One was Latina and one was identifying as Black. And their DNA results came out as predominantly white. And so we asked them the question, is this going to do anything in terms of changing your identification or your narrative? And both of them said, "I'm not going to change anything about how I identify because society will always see me this way."
Ah. Hey, Alondra Nelson, you want to jump in here on the concept of identity?
That's the truth of it. I think what the second professor just said is that, you know, I think that we give too much, we give too much power to genetic ancestry testing and sort of assume that it's more accurate or more powerful in how people identify. Certainly it is powerful. We live in a world that's shaped all around us by science and technology. But it's also the case that identity is about who others say you are as much as who you say you are. And so, you know, this is demonstrated in the gas pump example and then the both examples that they just shared. And it was certainly the case and the people that I spoke to as well. And I would add that this changes over time. So there is, you know, an early, when people first get their results, I think a kind of a wonderful excitement and an uptake, I think, a more robust uptake of what the test results tell you. But, you know, I spent almost a decade with some of the people I interviewed. And over time, you know, the way that it matters sort of ebbs and flows. And sometimes that matters more or less, or, you know, sometimes it's just something that people will, you know, bring up at a cocktail party with others who might have done the same thing. And sometimes it shapes how they travel or what they read or, you know, what kind of work they want to do in the world and sort of everything in between.
Well, Alondra, what are you hearing about how it might reshape family perception?
You know, this is really, I think this is one of the more interesting things, because what certainly genetic ancestry testing has accomplished is a remaking of kinship, a remaking of how we think about the family. So what was fascinating, it's been fascinating to me, is the use of phrases like DNA cousin, which on the one hand suggests that, you know, we are cousins, but the use of the term DNA in front of it, on the one hand, could suggest, you know, we are DNA cousins because DNA is how we establish our relationship to one another. But I also think that it suggests to us that we don't necessarily think that what DNA tells us are relationships in and of themselves. So it seems to me like a bit of a qualification, because if we thought that DNA told us what our families were, we would just say cousin. And so it's been very interesting to think about kinship and certainly the widening out what ancestry testing surely does, particularly if folks are using, you know, data that they can upload to sites that they can connect with conventional genealogy, is really show, you know, how many of us are related and how much similarity we share as the family tree gets bigger and bigger using both genetics and conventional or old-fashioned, one might say, genetic genealogy techniques.
And Alondra, just one quick note. In reading a little bit about you and your DNA testing, you're quoted as saying, the results of your testing are actually more meaningful to your mother. And the end result here is now you have a new family at the Thanksgiving table. Can you connect the dots for us?
Yeah. So, you know, I have one of those families that always takes another family. So there's often a new family at the Thanksgiving table. But last Thanksgiving, my mother, there was a Cameroonian family that goes to church with my mother. And they joined us at Thanksgiving and they brought roast goat with plantain. So we've added that to our menu of turkey and ham. And it was a wonderful experience and they've become great friends. And, you know, it's interesting though. They're from two different ethnic groups in Cameroon. They're technically, in Cameroonian culture, a mixed marriage in a kind of fairly controversial way.
You know what, Alondra? That this is so interesting, but we're up against a break, so just hold that thought. We're talking about DNA testing, reshaping identity, and we're also going to take some of your calls here at WHYY's Radio Times, 888-477-9499. Keep it here. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We are focusing on genetic ancestry testing and how results can sometimes call into question how we define ourselves. For the remainder of the hour, we are chatting with Alondra Nelson, Dean of Social Science at Columbia University and author of The Social Life of DNA. Bessie Lawton is a professor at Westchester University, as is Anita Foman, and we're talking about a student project that they have conducted regarding DNA testing. And again, the number to call if you'd like to jump into the conversation, 888-477-9499. I promised we'd get to some calls. Let's go there. Bradley is live with us now from Drexel Hill, Pennsylvania. Hello, Bradley.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
No problem.
I think everyone should. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, great. I think everyone should have their DNA ancestry done. My wife is from Kansas. They're German-speaking Mennonites. And when she had hers done, she found out that she was part Polynesian and part Spanish. And looking back in the family history, yes, her ancestors were in that part of the world. But, you know, it has the potential to really change the way that you look at your ancestry.
How did it reshape the conversation in your home, Bradley? Just curious.
Well, I mean, I guess it's a stereotype. My wife's from a very stoic Midwestern place, and finding out that she was part Spanish kind of made a little more sense.
Oh, it made a little more sense, huh? Maybe we don't go there. Bessie and Anita, you're both getting a bit of a chuckle.
Well,
thanks, Bradley.
It is interesting. Most of us can only go back a couple of generations. But if you think about the things that impact you from your parents' generation, if you go back one, two, three, there may be factors in your family that are not discussed anymore. People actually keep secrets about ethnicity and culture that may actually shape. So we don't know how far back that Spanish culture is, but there may be some cultural elements that go along with the genetic. We just don't know.
All right. Anna in Newark, Delaware, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thank you so much.
Sure. So what's your question?
Hello.
We are here and we are listening.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a quick question, not to derail the topic too much, but could you comment about maybe individuals having concern about their genetic information being known? I think I would love to have this kind of information about myself, knowing my genetics and maybe my ancestry, but I'm also a little worried and concerned about my genetic information being known in a company, and just wondering if you could comment a little bit about that, if anyone else has expressed that kind of concern.
That's a great question, and let me bring Alondra Nelson back into the conversation. Do you happen to know, Alondra, where the data from these tests generally go and how it might be used?
Yeah. This is a really important question, and I do worry that our stories about discovery and completion really hide or obscure this very important question. Companies do very different things with the data. So some companies claim to throw the tissue away, your sample away, which may or may not matter if they actually keep the data. The tissue, your saliva sample itself doesn't matter once they've analyzed it and made it into data. Some companies like 23andMe are now explicit that your data will be used for medical research, and in particular for looking for pharmaceutical applications, and might be used to advance an application for a pharmaceutical patent if they have success. So it's hard to know where the data goes. It's also the case that many genealogists are very much part of a kind of open source, quantified self culture, and are keen to leave their genetic data online for others to see. Surname groups that link patrilineage or wide DNA markers with last names will often leave those markers available for others to see. And we have at least one case in which a genealogy database was used by police authorities to try to locate a suspect in a cold case in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be, the suspect wasn't the person that they were looking for. So, I do worry that genetic ancestry testing can put a kind of halo effect over the real concerns that we should have about any kind of genetic data that we're sharing with anyone.
So,
please.
No, I was just going to ask then, moving forward, if somebody's considering doing this, how do you go into the procedure? What do you bring in mind? What do you keep in mind as you're considering perhaps taking one of these tests?
Mike, just to jump in a little, might somebody use their own name is something. Now, they with Ancestry.com, they give you a code, and then they say that they separate the code from your name, et cetera. But there's so much genetic information out there anyway, and they can use even your relatives to identify back to you. Mm-hmm. However, I do suggest if a student or whomever feels uncomfortable that they not use their own name.
Yeah. Anita Foman, thanks. And Alondra Nelson, and any thoughts on that too?
I think the name doesn't matter. Yeah. I mean, we have all sorts of biostatistics now that suggest that de-identifying data doesn't mean that you can't identify people. Sure. There's been terrific papers that show it's very easy to identify people. So it's very much, a buyer beware. And actually read the data. Different companies do very different things, make very different commitments to you as a consumer about what they're going to do with the data. And that arguably might be part of your decision as a consumer, what happens to the data.
How well regulated is this product? Do you know, Alondra, offhand?
It's not regulated at all as an industry. There's been various attempts for scientists, entrepreneurs working in the industry to sort of self-regulate. So there's been endeavors to do that. Laboratories are regulated. The reagents that they'd use in laboratories are regulated. But the actual industry itself is not regulated. And there's been, sort of clumsy attempts to regulate the industry. So some of your listeners might recall there was an attempt by the FDA to regulate 23andMe when it started doing medical testing. And that had, a kind of mixed outcome. 23andMe brought some people who do, medical experts on staff and stopped doing a few different tests. But generally, the ancestry piece alone, unless it ventures into medical testing, is not related at all.
Yeah. So I guess the bottom line, I think you were the one who said this earlier, Alondra, buyer beware. You know, it's kind of a fun thing to do, perhaps, but also, you know, be aware. All right. Let's take some more telephone calls here. Eric in Wallingford, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking the call. I have a comment and a question. So I had my DNA tested, and my family had always believed we were predominantly from Denmark, Danish, and found out that we're mostly Norwegian with some Scottish and other things. At least that's where I tested. So I don't mean this in a crude way, but I guess what I found about myself is that I'm kind of a mutt. And I suspect most of us are kind of mutts. And I had thought, okay, I'm mostly Norwegian. Mm-hmm. Told my sister-in-law, who's actually from Norway, that, oh, isn't this exciting? It turns out I'm mostly Norwegian. And she could not have cared less. Because in her mind, being Norwegian means you've lived in the country, you speak the language, you understand the culture. So my question is whether it's uniquely American to conceive of some of these origins as pure breed, or if you were to go in, for example, Norway and test, would you find that even those people are made up from a bunch of people from other places as well?
All right, interesting. And thanks, Eric. You know, we are a land of so many different peoples. Is identity really perhaps more of an American thing than it is in other countries? No, you're shaking your head.
I've had the opportunity to talk to people from India who came to Westchester to visit, and when I did the work in Africa, and they've all found it fascinating. So from different points of view. Oh,
well, this quest for identity is what I meant to say. Yeah.
Though one of my colleagues who was in Germany said, you know, this wouldn't be possible in Germany, because people do not do a lot of ancestry racial testing because of the history. Yeah. And so it some of it depends upon the history of the country.
But we were also talking yesterday, our conversation, do you remember, mm-hmm. when we were saying in the Philippines, people do not frame identity in terms of racial issues or race, because, you know, there's the Hispanics, and because we were colonized by Spain for 400 years, and then we have the Chinese, then we have the Filipinos, and we just don't talk about difference in terms of race. It's mostly social class in the Philippines. And I think in the United States, that's one of the things that really shocked me when I came here. Not really shocked, but was very different, was that a lot of the conversations in this country is framed around the issue of race.
Why is that, do you think? And Alondra, if you want to jump in.
It owes to the history of slavery, right? So we know that the slave trade was about taking, you know, making, using physical differences and making an explanation for, you know, a free labor force and a kind of way of slicing and dicing society that, you know, made sense based on that. So, and the United States is different, and that people come almost, you know, everyone comes from someplace else with the exception of indigenous people. And you know, we're very distinct in the world among other countries, including, you know, countries on the African continent that, you know, where folks in some instances have lived for a very long time and they're more similar to each other. You know, this sort of, you know, for good and for not, and it's very challenging. The multicultural, multiracial project of the United States, I think, makes genetic ancestry testing particularly interesting, and our society and societies that have that same feature.
Yeah, and power distance in the United States. I mean, we have the whole concept of equality in other countries, including the Philippines. Power distance, that you are expected to accept the power structure.
Right.
And here, even though we are frustrated that there is not equality, the goal of equality is there, and thus we talk about race and categorizing people. You know, we talk more explicitly about race and difference than places where people are supposed to accept the power structure.
As we approach the top of the hour here, let's get back to the student project at Westchester for a moment or so. And we were chatting off mic about how different students who identified differently, whether they have a European or a non-European background, this affected the family narrative.
Yes, one of the research questions we asked participants was whether the DNA test results would change their family narrative. And for those who identified as predominantly European, about a third of them said that it would not change their family narrative at all. But those who identified as non-European, for a third of them, they said that they would add that information to their narrative.
And can we break out what non-European means a little bit, or was that not available in the data?
We didn't break it out, but basically we're talking about African-American, Latino, Asian. And in other parts of this research, we looked at over and underestimation. And far and away, we found that European ancestry was overestimated more often. And it was partly because white students would tend to say, I'm 100% European. Mm-hmm. But we also found that other groups would tend to lean into that European profile because it's still seen as the profile of status.
Yeah. Anita, you know, you're quoted as saying that after the election, people on all sides are smarting. How do we approach each other again? Yeah. How do we?
And I think that's back to the goal of this project, to get people to start by looking within, looking at complexity within their own lives, with their own families, so that we can have a discussion about race that is that starts with some humility. And I also want to add that there's a certain amount of joy in our class that people have enjoyed. And while I think it seems Pollyanna on some level to say that, you know, we're having fun talking about race, I think we've all had very difficult experiences around race. And one of the nice things is here's a way to look at human diversity that's fascinating. And the students have loved it on all sides, from all ethnic backgrounds.
And to piggyback on that Pollyanna statement that you made, when we first asked people before they took the DNA test how they would react to the profile, and everybody was, half of them were very positive about it. But then after the DNA test, positive went down to about 10%. And,
really?
And categories such as angry, skeptical, upset increased tremendously. So it's really not a magical fairy tale study that we're doing here.
Yes, but it pulls people in a unique way.
Alondra Nelson, you want to? What is your take here? And again, we're talking about post-election and Anita's quote about folks smarting and how we approach each other again.
Yes. You know, I don't know that genetic ancestry testing offers any answers here. You know, some of you will recall that, you know, soon after the election, there was some reporting about the use of genetic ancestry testing by white nationalists to make white supremacist claims. And this has been the case. Most parts of Europe don't, the genetic ancestry testing isn't as popular as it is in the United States for some of the historical reasons we discussed a few moments ago. But it is true that there are people trying to make distinctions in Europe between Greeks and, you know, whether or not people are Mediterranean or whether or not they're Northern European. You know, are they descended from the Celts or the Norse, or are they descended from, you know, Sicilians? And so, you know, we've now had that come to the United States, this sort of parsing of, you know, even European, and are there, you know, parts of whiteness that can be discerned, inferred through genetic ancestry testing that make a difference? And so for me, you know, I think regrettably one of the things that's been opened up by this political moment is a conversation about genetic ancestry's role in making those more problematic claims.
Anita, you're nodding your head.
Well, just on that note, I mean, you have to look into the human heart. People use everything for all kinds of reasons. A gentleman who was a Holocaust survivor took the test. He was Eastern European, and he came up with Asian, a little bit of African, and he said, maybe this is the end of race. And I thought, oh, my God, this Holocaust survivor is making that comment. And I said, I don't think this is the end of race, but I'm glad to be in a world where someone like you can think something would mean the end of identifying people in that way. So I think it's if you want to approach this just like the Bible or anything else in a particular point of view, that you certainly do.
Yeah, quickly, Bessie, what next for the project?
We are actually about to begin the second phase of our project, and we've added some health behavior-seeking questions. And this is by no means what 23andMe was doing. We don't get DNA information to test your conditions, but we just sort of want to find out if people might use their DNA information to try and see conditions that are related to their race profile.
Next chapter. Okay, Bessie Lawton, thank you so much, an associate professor of communication studies at Westchester University. We appreciate your time here at Radio Times.
Thank you for having us. A pleasure.
Anita Foeman, a pleasure as well to have you here with us in studio, professor of communication studies at Westchester University.
Thanks so much.
And Alondra Nelson, great to have you with us. Alondra Nelson is dean of social science at Columbia University and author of The Social Life of DNA, Race, Reparations, and Reconciliation After the Genome. Thanks so much, Alondra.
A pleasure. Thank you.
And don't forget, visit our Facebook page. Check out our podcasts at whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us today.